Also Barbara Kraus has joined the group recently, has joined this project too. And I mainly talk about quantum chromatography complexity and some applications of it. So the first thing I'll do is, well, define chromatography complexity. First in the classical setting, so what it is and why do people study it. And then also generalize to the quantum setting. And as you'll see, there have been various definitions for this quantity. And in the second part, I'll give you some applications and also talking about communication complexity, I'll be able to prove how, in some sense, some definitions are, let's say, better than others, in the sense that they do allow some physical application. And to do this, I'll first introduce the SMP model and the fingerprinting protocol, of whom I think you know something about. And so how the results in this theory allow for some conditions of quantum chromatography. So since one of the definitions I'll introduce up here does satisfy this condition, I'll talk a little about it, giving some details about it, its relations with entanglement, and then some applications both in communication complexity and in computation complexity. So first of all, some general introduction that is no surprise to you. So physics and information are strongly related to one another. And the concepts from information theory have been successfully adopted in quantum physics. So what happened then? We had classically these bits, and as you know, we generalized them to quantum bits or qubits. This simple change has actually modified profoundly the theory. There have been generalization of most concepts that are well known in classical information theory, from channel entropy, we obtain from non-entropy. Various error correction and coding theorems have been generalized. What has been left to the last possible place was chromatography complexity. The first generalization of quantum chromatography complexity are only up to the 2000-2001, and there's never been much work on it. And as I'll show you, there is actually classical chromatography complexity is quite a powerful tool, so there is actually a hope that generalizing it to the quantum setting will give a powerful tool both in quantum information and in more in general in some quantum physics issues. So, okay, you know Shannon entropy. The idea is you get a random variable x that outputs some output xi with some probability pi. So what does it do? It measures mainly the information that we gain on average when you get to know this random variable x. At the same time, it measures the uncertainty we have before knowing. It's related to the information transmission of the channels via the Shannon's noiseless or noisy channel coding theory. And of course, it has been generalized to quantum states. But as I told you, it looks at averages. So quite a natural question is, what happens is if I'm interested in a single output of the source, not on a general output on average? And this is the question that has been addressed by a chromatograph and which is answered by chromatograph complexity. What happens? Imagine that I have two sequences of coin tosses. One is like all tails and one is some head, tails and whatever. So if I restrict myself to probability theory, these two sequences have exactly the same probability. In this case, it's 2 to the minus 10. But at the same time, imagine to prolong these strings, if I told you that I tossed that coin for 100 times and always obtained tails, most of you will start suspecting that my coin was biased. So in some sense, we intuitively have an idea of what is more random. And we associate this more or less randomness to the structure of the underlying sequence. Also, we notice that to describe these two sequences is very different. In this first case, it's easier. I can say that you just write 10 times tails. And if I have 100 of them, it still remains very easy to describe. In the second case, though, I have to really tell you every single output of this coin toss. So there seems to be some sort of relation between what we see as random and the complexity of the description of the subject. So this was an intuitive idea, and formally this relationship is given by the homograph complexity. The idea is we'll get an n-bit string of this form, and the idea is that it is complex. If it's very hard to explain to a computer how to build this sequence. So mainly what happens is that I define the complexity of a string as the length of the shortest program that allows this computer to output the string I want. Okay, as a computer you get a universal Turing machine, and luckily one can prove that this quantity is not that much dependent on the Turing machine. That is, if you change universal Turing machine, you're going to add a constant to the complexity, but on the limit of the very large ends, it will count. So you end up omitting the dependence on the machine here. Just a notice, since everybody talks about complexity, then everybody thinks about computation complexity, this is different. We are absolutely not interested in how long the computer takes to output the string. So it's very different. So there are some relatively easy properties that are, though, important. The first thing is that, well, the complexity of an n-bit string is bound by the length of the string itself, plus a constant. The idea is that I can always tell the computer, okay, start writing, and then start telling him 0, 1, 1, 0, go on for it. This leads to defining a complex string as a string that has maximum complexity, so complexity that grows linearly with its length. The other thing that makes it a little tricky is that the homograph complexity of a string is uncomputable. You can prove this, it's related to the Holton problem. So if you were able to say that the complexity of a given string is that, you could prove a bunch of impossible things. What you can do, though, is to give upper bounds to the complexity of strings. And this is relatively easy in some cases. If, for example, in the previous case, when we had the sequence of all tails, the complexity of that string is bound by a logarithm in the length, because I just need to specify how many tails you need to write down. An interesting thing is that for any given n, there is at least one complex string. Of course, by what I've told you here, I can't tell you which one it is, but I know that there is at least one, and this is proven by a simple counting argument. So why are people interested in classical homograph complexity? And the idea is that it is actually a concept that has applications in very diverse fields. One of the main applications is the fact that it can be used as a general proof method for in many, many different fields, like number theory, like logic, finite automata. And the idea of this general proof method is very easy. So it looks trivial. The idea is I build up some complex string and then say that if the proposition I want to prove is true was false, then the initial string would not be complex. Now, given this way, it's not too clear, so maybe I can show you a very, very easy example. And the example I want to prove is that there are infinitely many primes. Okay, this can be proven in various different ways, but there is also a very simple argument based on homograph complexity. How do I prove this? Well, I know that every integer n can be written as a product of some primes. At the same time, where these are some prime numbers, and each of these exponents is smaller than the logarithm of this prime, of this number. So imagine now that there are at most big k primes. So they are finite. What would happen here? Well, I can get any number, now this m here, and I can write it down using all of these k primes. So what happens is that this is described by the exponents. So in order to define and describe m, I just have to describe the single exponent. Now, I'm interested in the complexity of that. So what happens? Well, this is bound by the sum of the complexity of these guys. But since each of them is smaller than this, then this is bound by k times the complexity of each of these. Now, k times the complexity of each of these. Each of these is log n, so it's now, if I take, let's assume now that I choose n to be complex and larger than k log n.
So you mean m is a composite? By complex, you mean composite, it's a product?
No, complex in the sense that the
Okay.
complexity
okay.
of n is maximum.
Yeah, no, I understand. You were thinking of the other meaning.
Yeah, so it's exactly the idea. Now, what happens is that if I check the relationship between these two guys, you see that if this is if the number of primes is finite, this is actually strictly smaller than n.
Log n,
yeah,
yeah.
Which is the length.
Don't you need to include p1 to p10 in your description?
That's a constant. So in principle, you have to, but I can get this guy large enough. So this is true. Plus, actually, that define this thing here, which is like something that is strictly smaller than k times log of k. So by taking this thing larger by that constant, I can always do it. For every number, this thing can be complex. So, as you see, this is this proves my hypothesis that the n was complex. So this is the idea, and okay, this proof is particularly simple, and the proposition itself was quite simple. But you can in general use it in other contexts too.
Sorry, I just don't see the contradiction.
Yes.
Okay.
This is the hypothesis.
Okay, so what does this prove?
So this proves that there can't be finite primes. They must be infinitely many.
Ah, okay.
Just that proof can hold only if the primes are finite. Okay. As I told you, that proof is particularly simple. The proposition itself is almost trivial to prove. But you can generalize it and prove it. Use it to prove like very many things. With Gödel's theorem also can be proven this way, the Hölting problem and this. Relationship, well, what happens is that as regards more physics than computer science or number theory, is the fact that the Kolmogorov complexity is related to the Shannon entropy rate of sources. And also using some theorems from chaos, the classical chaos theory, you can prove that it's related, the Kolmogorov complexity of trajectories in a chaotic system must be maximal. So in some sense, the Kolmogorov complexity of encoded trajectories is related also to the Lyapunov exponents of a classical system. Okay, trivially, a hopeless string is incompressible by definition. If I need to write as many bits as the string itself to reproduce it, I can't compress it. So, now, as I showed, I hope I convinced you, even if it's quite a quick overview, that classical Kolmogorov complexity is quite a well-known concept, and it also has a broad range of applications. So, of course, we have quantum information now, and it would be nice to be able to extend all concepts that are known in classical information theory to the quantum phase. So the first question is, well, okay, fine, but what is Kolmogorov complexity in the context of quantum information? Well, the first thing is, we're talking about the Kolmogorov complexity of what? In classical theory, it's easy. You have bits 0 or 1, and the only way thing you can do with it is putting one after the other. And so you can generate a string of bits. But in the quantum case, you have qubits, and of course you can consider a string of qubits, just like tensor products of qubits. But it doesn't seem like the most general thing you can do, and it isn't, because you can consider entangled states. So usually when people consider a quantum homomorphic complexity, they are talking about complexity of states. And look at this as the generalization of string of bits. The second question is, what do you want? In classical theory, it's quite easy. I can ask to reproduce exactly that bit string. But you have an advantage in the classical case, and this is that given a finite number of bits, that all possible bit strings are finite. In this case, not only have an infinitely many states, but you have continuous of them. So are you really requiring your computer to reproduce exactly your state, or would you accept some sort of approximation? And how do you measure the complexity? So classically, you measure the number of bits you need to reproduce your output. Quantumly, you want to consider measure the number of bits again, or the number of qubits.
So classically, there's one more possibility for state, which would be probability distribution.
Yeah, this hasn't been studied a lot. I think that the idea is that in that case, you would simply need to describe the probabilities and the strings that were our output. So, you face a similar problem if you consider in the quantum case mixed states. Even if you define the complexity of a pure state, then you have this problem. And that hasn't been studied a lot. What we propose is that to consider the purification of the mixed state and want to describe that. So you actually give a full description of the mixed state, and this would be equivalent in the classical case to describe the probabilities. Of course, if you're assuming real numbers up to some precision, and the single bit strings, the outputs. This is not unique, but as I know of, there is not much about that, how you can extend it.
So you'd want to describe this string of 2 to the n probabilities?
Sorry?
So would you want to describe a string of 2 to the n probabilities, 2 to the n real numbers?
Yes, that's a problem. In the quantum case, that will end up being one of the main problems.
So it seems that you'll require something like n times 2 to the n.
Orders of that, yeah. It's going to be very large. Yeah. But that's one of the points I'm going to address. It's not that what we obtain in our definition is not the only thing you can obtain. There have been other definitions, there have other bounds. I'll show how, given some conditions, you'd really need that many qubits, that many classical bits. I'll show it later on. The third case is you want to talk about the Turing machine or some other model, in the sense that, again, in the classical theory, the classical Turing machine is quite a simple model, and when affirmed, it's not so much in the quantum case, in the sense that there are other models that seem more natural for certain models to name them.
Actually, continuing your question, so maybe if you want to describe the classical polynomial complexity of a probability distribution, you should use the randomized Turing machine, right?
Yeah. Right. There have been some, of course, if you randomly define some probability output in your Turing machine, then you automatically get the right source. But it's again a little tricky because it really depends on what you're looking at. We face the same problem with in mixed states, because it really depends on what you want from the state you reproduce. You want it exactly. In that case, it's not sufficient to have one random output that satisfies that statistics, but you really want all possible descriptions. Okay, so as I anticipated, there are many definitions. The first one I introduce is, you can summarize the idea of the different definitions by a simple thing. You have a quantum computer. You can imagine that this guy here does different things. Mainly, it can accept classical inputs or quantum inputs. At the same time, here it can have some sort of internal quantum state, so accepting classical bits will somehow describe, tell it how to modify this internal quantum state. Then it will output, of course it can output a state or a bit state. In this case, it's quite easy to go from one to the other by measuring. So mainly in the case of quantum conglomerate complexity, we are considering one of these two possibilities. So either we consider our quantum computer as something that accepts a quantum input and gives out a quantum output, and this leads to this definition here. Or you will look at a computer that accepts a classical input, modifies an internal quantum state, and gives a quantum output. And this will be the approach that the two definitions that follow will consider. The idea here is the very trivial extension of the classical definition. Why this? Because, well, again, what you do is get the classical and move wherever you have a bit, a qubit, and that satisfies everything. So what you consider is a machine that gets a quantum input, a quantum output, and you look how long this quantum input must be in order to be able to reproduce this quantum output. And it's quite easy to see that the bound for this definition of complexity is linear in the number of qubits of the initial state. Why this? Because, of course, again, I can insert exactly the state itself and just tell the machine, don't do anything about it, and throw it out.
Don't you use something like a universal quantum Turing machine?
Universal, yeah, okay. I'm omitting most places universal. I'm considering all those universal.
But then this is universality with respect to quantum programs, I mean, which might be different from universality.
Yes, this is one of the issues. That's why I'm saying this work, as you can see, is like 6 years old, but still has not been worked on a long time, because there are some problems related to quantum universality. You know, there's no universal quantum processors, so it's not very clear what you have inside your machine in order to tell it don't do anything and just output your state. So this is just like a little tricky. Nevertheless, it is useful, and it has been proven, and it's quite nice. That is related to the Fermat entropy rate of some sources. So in some sense, it satisfies some of the relationships that were known in classical. Yep.
Right. Just to go back a bit, so what exactly is meant by the smallest filter space containing?
Okay, the idea is that your state can be modified by a unitary and to live into a subspace of your Hilbert space that is spanned by a fewer number of basis vectors, then you take the logarithm of that thing. So it's, okay, write down, it depends on the basis vectors you fix, but imagine you fix your computational basis vectors and write it up, and then just take the logarithm of the number of basis vectors you need.
Okay, so you're fixing some computational?
Of course, you need to fix something, because if not, I can always take that
one
guy as a basis. Yes. Okay. Oh, what's this? Never mind. Why are you doing this? It didn't work. It worked beforehand. Let's do it this way. Yeah, very true. I don't know what happened.
Lossy.
I swear I ran it beforehand and it worked, but, well, never mind. So, what are you doing to see it by? Oh, never mind. Let's try to do it this way. I write it on a blackboard. So, well, the idea is, there are two definitions that consider instead a classical input and a quantum output. What is the basis of this definition is that you can't require your quantum state to be reproduced exactly, because you want a finite classical input and it must describe somewhat sense of continuous. The first definition, which is very, very bad, you can't read it from here, I'll write it down. The idea is this: you define the complexity of a quantum state phi as, I write it down, so you want the minimum overall program, as in the classical case, of what? Of the length of the program, such that the universal machine running on B given some initial state phi gives not my Well, not phi again. This is horrible. Sorry. It's not the state phi I wanted at the beginning, but some state phi t of it. Now, I need to consider this phi t of it is not the right one. And what Paul Vitani proposes is to include that as a penalizing factor. So what happens is that if you reproduce this the state very badly, this overlap is very low, this whole thing blows up, and your state becomes very complex.
What is psi in that definition?
It's some internal state of your machine. It could be just zero tensor n or whatever. It was a quantum machine, but it has a classical input. It must have a quantum internal state. It must modify something quantum if you want that quantum algorithm.
So why is your penalizing factor locked of the overlap?
This is a big question. In the sense that it's, there's no real reason we could find in why this thing was chosen. In some sense, yep.
Terms of this form are occasionally used in semi-definite programming in order to basically find successively better optima, so it's probably just technically.
Yeah, no, it can be explained also another way. There is some, so imagine that I fix a basis. Now, if I fix a basis for my states, that would, in some sense, this would be, if I just enumerate, I put this state as the output I want as a state of my basis. And then this measures the overlap between the two things. And since the vectors in the basis are finite, this would be the number I would need to require which of the gates. So it's quite a standard manner of enumerating thing. You just enumerate from the largest probability to the smallest, and this would be the number of bits you need.
This definition might be very sensitive to the initial state psi.
This definition might be
complicated state.
No, what happens is that this definition has, as I showed later, a very trivial bound, which is again linear in the number of qubits. Why this? Because I can always tell you output. So given that this state is normalized, there is at least one basis vector with which it has overlap at least 2 to the minus n. So I can always choose a strategy for which this thing is n by saying, okay, output that particular basis vector. This is not that much better than throwing out a random state if n is large. But there is always this strategy, and in this case, it doesn't really matter the initial state. So for the bound, there's no there's no correlation to the initial state. For the single state, indeed, it must change. But as you see, this will be a common problem because you need something to start with. So the most easier thing to solve the problem is, okay, I'll probably take something here which is in an initial internal state, some purely separable tensor product state, which is sort of classical, so that I don't change that much things, but it's arbitrary.
I mean, it could mean that's another reason to choose the lock, right? Is it makes an upper bound that's linear.
Yeah, that could be another reason to choose the lock, sure. The problem is that this upper bound, as I told you, is obtained by simply more or less throwing out a random state. In the sense, you have an upper bound that is n, but if you have a state whose complexity is n, you more or less have no idea of what state you have. The other proposal I don't know where it was. I hope it's in these slides. You want to consider the bits that are needed to the classical bits are needed to describe what the procedure that you need to prepare the state. So, okay, this is possible to do in a classical fashion if you're assuming that you don't want to prepare it exactly, but you accept some error epsilon in this overlap. It's possible because experimentalists always do it. They show you what circuit or what experimental setup they build. In this case, as I told you, the bound is linear, that's at least 2n. And in this case, you obtain the exponential bound about which we talked before. Now, there's a little side tour. I'm going to talk a little about communication complexity because, as you'll see later, some of the results here can be applied both to explain some properties of quantum cryptography complexity and to, and quantum cryptography complexity can also be used and applied to this scenario. So what's the idea? Well, the idea is very simple. There's Alice, there's Bob. Each of them has a classical input. And they want to solve a function that is a function of both inputs. Of course, they can do it only if they communicate. And the idea is that classical communication complexity of the function is the minimum number of bits that Alice and Bob need to exchange in order to compute this function. Okay, the bound is linear and is trivial because, of course, if Alice sends her whole input to Bob, he can, of course, solve the function exactly. There are very different models in which one can consider communication complexity. One might be interested in the worst case scenario, in the sense, what happens if the two inputs Alice and Bob have are really unlucky? Or in some sort of expected communication. What's the difference here? Imagine that you have a function that is zero for all inputs of Alice and Bob except one. Now, in the average, the expected communication can be quite low, because on average they can just output zero and do a small mistake, but it's reason. But in the worst case, it might be more complicated. Again, without error or with error, do you want them to give your result exactly every single time? Are you accepting that they might fail with some probability? Okay. And of course, they might share something in a random key. They might later on share entanglement when they discover quantum theory. So there are plenty of possible forces. What we will consider is the worst case scenario with a probabilistic error. So I'm accepting that they have some failure probability epsilon in computing this function. As you'll see, this is the one of the cases in which quantum communication can actually improve the results of classical. What is the model we are considering? The model is simultaneous message passing. It's a slightly different model. The idea is, again, you have Alice and Bob, but this time there is a third party, the referee, and it's him who must calculate the value of the function. What's the difference? The difference is that Alice cannot talk to Bob, nor vice versa, but they can must both communicate to the referee. So, of course, you might expect the communication complexity to be higher, because imagine the trivial case we explained before, Alice just sent her whole input to Bob. But it's not sufficient for Alice to send the whole input to the referee, but Bob has to do it too. So the bound is now 2n, because they both have to send the whole input. But one can consider they can send some sort of fingerprints of their state, in the sense that it's not always necessary to send the whole input. Except if you are accepting some failure probability, that if you can choose like very low or whatever, then there might be some very smart strategy in which they don't need to send the whole thing. And this is the idea. And this is an example is equality. So what the referee wants to know is whether Alice's and Bob's inputs are the same. And of course, if they want to do it exactly, there's no other choice. They have to send the whole inputs to the referee. But we'll see that if there is, if you're accepting some error probability, then it is not necessary. What's the idea? I'm not going to describe the protocol very well, because you can ask Alice there if he can explain it better than me for sure. But the general idea is this. So Alice and Bob both encode their input string using some error correcting code. What's the idea of this code? The idea of this code is that they take the string, they make them longer, but such that the Hamming distance is greater. And then they send only part of this long string to the referee. This part, of course, is not chosen randomly, but according to a very smart strategy. But what this avoids is that they only need to square root of n bits, and then by comparing these two square root of n bits, the referee can determine whether actually the two inputs were the same or not, with some failure probability. It happens that the probability that the referee makes a mistake is determined by the probability that mainly that the ith bit of the string EX and the ith bit of the string EY are the same if this, these two strings are different, where I is some any I that Alice and Bob choose. And this can is smaller than delta because of the choice of the Serret correcting.
So this is where there's no shared randomness?
There's no shared randomness, there's nothing. They just have their inputs. You're just accepting some error probability. And you can reduce this error probability delta by sending multiple copies of these, by repeating the protocol more than once. So what actually happens is that this is proven to be optimal. So in classical theory, there's no way you can do better than that. You need to send order of square root of n bits in order to solve the equality problem. But why is this so interesting? This is so interesting, as we should know, because it does change in quantum case. And I'll explain how in the next slide. First of all, I just defined what quantum communication complexity is. And it's exactly as the classical case, only that they can communicate at quantum state. And what you will measure is the number of qubits they are sending. And the SMP model is exactly the same. They just send to the referee at quantum state. Now, Holebo says that with one qubit cannot transmit more than a single bit of information. So this might seem to imply that quantum communication cannot help. But what we must remember is that we are interested in one single bit, which is the function of x and y. So actually, we'll see there's no trick. We're not violating Holebo's bound in any way. We're just using the quantum correlation, the quantum state, to be able to compress information better. So equality can be solved, actually, in the quantum scenario with a gradient improvement. And the protocol that does this is called quantum fingerprinting. And it works, you can mainly imagine it as two different paths. The first one is a classical path, which is, the encoding of the initial strings with this error correcting code. And the second part is the encoding of the longer string into quantum states. So quantum states, as you can see, are superpositions of the bits that represents the long string plus some label. Now, you just count them and they are order of logarithm of n. What has been proven is that actually with these guys you can solve equality with the same probability as in the classical case. Why this? Well, they send these two guys to the referee who starts with the state and applies a smart but very easy classical quantum circuit. There's just two Hadamards on the swap. Obtaining this state here. Now, as you see, there is some zero here where there's a superposition with a plus, and here you've got a minus with a flag one. What he does now is the referee measures this state, 1 and 0. And what happens? Well, of course, now we've got this thing and we measure these colored qubits. But if the referee measures 1, he knows for sure that these two guys could have been equal because if not, this part of the superposition wouldn't be there. And the error comes from where? Comes from the fact that whenever the referee measures 0, he decides that the two inputs, x and y, were the same. Now, of course, this leads to a probability. And you can prove by just looking at this and how the way the two states were constructed that this probability is smaller than this number here. Of course, again, if I send multiple copies of these states, I can reduce the error as much as I want. Now, what's the communication cost? In the quantum case, we just said that we've got order of log n. In the classical case, the optimal was square root of n. So what happens is that you do have an exponential gap between quantum and classical communication. Now, what does this relate to cosmological complexity? So the idea was, now we are using quantum state to transmit classical information. So what if we simulate the quantum protocol classically? What do I do? Well, Alice applies the code state. She describes the final state phi x. I just wrote it down earlier so I can do it. And then she sends a description, these k or phi x bits, to the referee. And Bob does exactly the same thing. Now, the referee gets the two description of the two states, and he classically simulates the circuit he had. So now we've got classical communication of the complexity of phi x plus complexity of phi r of y bits. But of course, this protocol is as good as optimal. I can't hope I've done best just by simulating. So this means that the sum of these two complexities must be order of square root of that, at least. So there must be an exponential growth between the of the cosmological complexity of this of a state and the number of qubits of which the states are made. I don't know what happens. I don't know. Well, never mind. So what happens is that it implies a logical one. For some reason, it doesn't treat it. So if the quantum number of complexity wants to measure the number of bits that are needed to describe a state, in a way that you can prepare it, in the sense that you have all the information you need to simulate an experiment on that state or to apply some protocol on it or whatever, then the complexity must grow exponentially with the number of qubits of the state. Now, if you recall, we had two definitions that for the complexity were based on the classical formation. Why? The third one I introduced was made of quantum bits, but of course the argument before doesn't apply because we are considering this comparison between classical communication of quantum. So we had two of them. One was based on quantum Turing machine, this one here. And the second one was based on a description of a preparation procedure, which we chose to be a surface ball because we're more used to talk about them. In the first case, we had a linear bound, and the second case, we had an exponential one. So what this seems to imply is that this definition here is somehow lacking all the properties that we require to really describe fully the state. This, of course, comes as no surprise, but because somehow you know that you can't describe a general quantum state with only n classical bits. But still, you can prove this using that if you wanted to use this description, then you would violate the classical optimality bound. So what I'll do now is to talk a little better about this definition of complexity and show how it's really related to some communication and computational issues. Okay, I've done a trick here. This definition does have an explicit dependence on the error parameter. This one didn't, because it was included inside the minimum. This one had, but you can prove that you can do the same argument and that this dependence on the error doesn't really, is decoupled from the dependence on error. It just has a constant on everything. So the idea of this definition called network complexity, simply because we defined it on a circuit, is this. So it all, and somehow the way, this is the way it was born, and it somehow explains why it worked out in some communication issues. Because the idea was this: imagine that Alice has just built a beautiful state and is sure that Bob would enjoy having it too, because it's a very interesting state. Well, either she has a quantum phone and she sends the state to Bob, but A, they're not available at the moment, and B, this would have some drawbacks, because at least Bob would have no clue about what state he has in his hands. So he might know that he has an interesting state, but not know what to do with it. Or the other thing she can do, and it's what people are doing now, is she just describes the state to Bob. She can choose a vast number of ways. One thing she can do is to explain how to prepare it. In order to do this, they have to have agreed on some basic ideas. But one thing is that they use the same toolbox. When I tell you that I'm applying a Hadamard gate, you are going to apply a Hadamard gate, not a C knot. So you just decide. This is the second part. you want to use some finite Lego pieces of it, not infinitely many of them, because if not, it's going to take a long time to explain which one you're using. And the second thing is, of course, that you have agreed that you're understanding each other. You're not one speaking French and the other German. So if you're considering a circuit model, this would be some complete and finite gate basis. And this is technically speaking, our code is simply some law that associates to an operation a letter or set of letters. This would hold, the same prescription would hold true if she chose, for example, to describe the single coefficients of the expansion of some basis. They would define some finite basis for the Hilbert space, and then they would just define some precision, they have to define some precision which they want to give the single coefficients, and they must understand that if I'm saying 1, it's 1, and it's not 12. So what? Once they have agreed on this, Alice simply has to send Bob the classical word that creates a circuit. So it's somehow a classical quantum homomorphic complexity, because it's going to be based on a classical description of something. Just a thing, if here you add the requirement that they choose single qubit and qubit gates, what you have is that there is an invariance of the final quantity on the basis change up to a constant again. So, just to show it in a picture, what you have is the quantum state that Alice has in her hand. And from the quantum state, you build up a circuit that prepares your state well enough. Here, you see, we chose to start from an initial state, 0. We're going to assume that this state is separable, because, well, completely separable. Why? Because I want it to be easier to describe how many qubits I want at the beginning. At the same time, you could define a GZ state of any state, any quantum state that has an easy extension to any number of qubits. And the circuit will depend on the precision with which I want to define a state. But if I'm interested in any random state, then this circuit will be very easy. And on the gate basis I've chosen. Then what I do is I code this circuit. So again, as you do normally in a paper, you just write Hadamard, you don't do it. And then you try to compress this classical description as well as you can. So you're going to send to the person the homomorphic complexity of that thing in bits. Okay, of course, you might not have chosen the best possible circuit, so you're going to have to optimize the thing, getting the minimum overall circuits. Now, okay, it's very hard to compute. The complexity itself is uncomputable. It's uncomputable in the classical theory, so it's not that much surprising. It's adding some extra difficulties. Just if you're going to consider upper bounds, it's going to be sufficient. You're going to add an extra approximation due to the fact that your circuit might not be optimal, but it's not going to count that much. No. So, just to show that, since we chose to talk about this definition of complexity because it's scaled exponentially with a number of qubits, I'm just going to show very briefly how you prove it. And the idea is extremely simple. In the same way, it's based on a counting argument. The counting argument is the thing on which is the Solberg-Pyle theorem is based, and that's the theorem we're going to use. So the idea is that the action of any unitary on your initial state can be implemented with finite precision using this order of gates. Okay, there is actually an n factor in front, but it's going to be destructed by this 2 to the n. Of course, now, if you need this number of gates, more or less you're going to use this number of coding words, of letters, because more or less you're going to have one letter for a gate. So you're going to need this number of, which is exactly the value we've been using. Intuitively it's trivial. What you have is a hypersphere in your huge Hilbert space of any qubits, and you want not to define this single small state here, which is a single point in this continuum, but something like a patch. Okay, you're happy with any state which is close enough to your guy. So what you can do is just to count these sort of patches which are sort of polar caps on this.
What is counted here? Is it the dimension?
It's the number of qubits that are under here of 5. So the dimension of the Hilbert space is 2 to the n. Using this notation just to divide the qubits, n qubits, cubes times for the number of qubits.
So I'm confused. You have all those 2 to the n log 1 over epsilon, and then how will we move the order? You just have 2 to the n?
Oh, I'm hiding it in this simple I'm not a computer scientist, so I'm using, well, it's, I don't know, I found it in most papers on polymorphism. It just added as a sim down there. It has the fact that there are some constants here that are smaller. I think I did it also in the classical case. I should have if I have it, because there's always that small guy, which is a constant hidden. So it's more up to smaller orders. What's nice of this definition of complexity is that it is related to some fundamental quantities in quantum information. The first one is entanglement. So I like to think that, at least in some sense, this definition does distinguish between entangled and non-entangled state, in some sense. The first case is, well, consider a fully separable product state of this form here. Now, of course, it's easy. I can always reproduce it in this way. There's a trick here. It's because I started with a separable state. Of course, if I want a connection with entanglement, I'm going to try to start with something I can measure zero of entanglement or maximal. Since I have multipartite setting, I'm just going to consider the initial fully separable state. Then in this case, I need only any unitaries, and this implies easily that the complexity of a separable state is scales only linearly with a number of qubits. So in some sense, the absence of entanglement reestablishes the classical model with a correction. Well, this correction is trivial. You don't have zero or one. You have any number in between. So you need to tell me your angle. Well, you can consider a state which is separable with respect to some partition. And in this case, the expression is a little more ugly. It has this form here. But the interesting thing is that it's always smaller than the maximum. So only when the state you're considering is a truly entangled entangled state, then you can have maximal complexity. Of course, it would be very nice if the opposite hold it too, but it's false, in the sense that there are maximal entangled states that are very easy to describe. G is that state, to name one. Well, it's not even a huge surprise. Most states you can come up with are not going to be entangled, if not, they're not going to be complex, if not all of them. Why? Because you're using them to do things. And if you're going to need exponentially many letters to write them down, you're not going to do anything with them. This relationship is actually a little more precise. And it can be expressed in the using the Schmidt measure of entanglement. This measure has, well, it based on the idea that, well, any state phi can be written as a superposition of separable states with respect to some partition. Now, if I consider the minimum number of terms here that are required reader to write a similar decomposition for phi, then the logarithm of this number is actually a measure of entanglement. It's discrete, it's not continuous, but aside from that, it's a monotone and it behaves correctly. Now, if I consider the minimal partition, in the sense that each party has only one single qubit, then there is a relationship between the entanglement of my state and the complexity of the state itself. And this relationship can be proven, since I'm going to prove that the complexity of my state phi is bound by a function of its entanglement, by expressing the Schmidt measure. I'm going to prove this bound by showing that this particular circuit is going to prepare phi. And the idea is, again, I start from my state. I prepare my ancilla in a smart superposition, which is simply the superposition given the right weights of numbers. So we're going to... Where did I put my short here? So the idea is I've got my state phi, and I wrote it down as a sum with the optimal number of terms of some alpha i's, phi i's, and these guys are separable. So what I do first is I prepare some ancilla qubits in a state which is a superposition of alpha i in this form. So I somehow split the complexity of this guy in the complexity of the weights and the preparation of these separable states. The advantage is that this ancilla state is on log r qubits. So the maximal complexity of the state A here is given by Q to the logarithm of the number of terms. So this is the Schmidt measure of the state times, again, the logarithm. Then I prepare each of these single states here. Well, these are separable, and so we've just proven that they have this linear bound. And then what I do is I apply each of them. There should be some vertical line here that I seem to have omitted. So it simply is a conditional application of each of these circles on the fact that the select is on state I. This is, might be a little tricky, but you can prove that this is described easily using this number of gates, of letters. So the end of the story, what you have is that the complexity of a quantum state phi is upper bound by 2n times the Schmidt measure of, well, the exponential of the Schmidt measure, the number of terms that appear in this sum here. So this proves not only that only a maximally fully and partly entangled state have had maximum complexity, but really it depends on the entanglement properties of the state.
Sorry, so what are you doing with the install at the end there? You're measuring in the Hadamard basis?
Yes, I'm just measuring on the computational basis, on the superposition here. I'm throwing away the LC there.
So you're projecting?
I'm just projecting.
So
yes.
So what do you do?
You're measuring in the computational basis?
No, I'm just projecting the answer now and throwing it away, thinking this is the whole idea.
But isn't then the state that you're pairing still entangled?
No, what I have here, at that point there, so before the measurement, I have a state which is sum over I of alpha I pi I. Now I can project on the superpositions of I's.
How will you get the state phi?
I project on superpositions of I's. I throw away the I's, maybe.
Sorry, but you can't throw them away because it's entangled. But you're measuring in the Hadamard basis. Is that it?
Yes.
But then you have to do, and then you do conditional operations.
It's probabilistic. I'm going to fail most of the time.
Okay.
But again, that's why it enters the one of the first slides when I was saying I'm not looking at computation complexity, I'm coming out of algorithmic complexity. I'm just going to say, if you obtain the wrong number, try again.
Okay.
But this is for free in algorithmic complexity. So the circuit is highly inefficient, but it's very easy to describe.
That's actually answering one of the other questions I was going to ask later. So you're allowing that sort of thing.
Yes, as long as it's easy.
It wasn't actually clear from the definition.
No, it isn't. What happens is that you can vary the things, as long as you're including things that are easy to describe according to some initial things. So if you're allowing basis states, any simple transformation on them, you can allow it. It won't change anything.
Right, but so you're allowed to prepare a mixed state, for instance, that has high fidelity.
Yes.
You
should be allowed to do that. Yeah.
And you don't really care what state the ancilla is left in, if it's left in some very complicated state.
No, because you're looking only at these guys here.
Okay.
So of course you're allowed to add ancilla qubits as long as they are in an initial easy state, because it's gonna be for free. I'm just telling you, okay, get another N of them. And again, I can allow probabilistic stuff because if I just measure the thing, and if I'm unlucky, I'm just gonna do it again. But I've already described you the circuit, so this is the information I need to tell you. Then you're gonna wait forever, and it's not gonna work very well. But it does actually do the job.
I don't realize. Still some doubt. So the phi is orthogonal. So phi is orthogonal to phi j.
No.
But then how will you? What kind of operation will you do to get summation alpha I phi I?
I'm not getting information on phi I. I'm just having this proposition. What I have want to have a bit here is I want to get this at the end of the story.
If you do the Hadamard on the ancilla and you measure them all, you get all zeros.
Okay.
Then I think you have it correct.
Yes. If you don't get all zeros, try it again. If you repeat it enough, but I don't need to tell you how many times you have to repeat or anything. I'm just telling you, when you get all zeros, you're lucky, and you've got your state. if not repeated. Since I'm only trying to describe this state, this is allowable. Okay.
What if you never get oscillated?
What is each time? It's probably 1 over 2 to the end. So is it, so after,
sooner or later you have
after
to.
After doing it many, many times, the probability will eventually.
You're going to have to do it exponentially.
It's always 1 over 2 to the end. I mean
it's.
Yes,
the number.
I think so.
The number of states that you have in there. R.
Oh, R. Okay.
1 over.
So you're going to have a probability. This is.
It could be much smaller, but the fact that it's not zero. Schmidt rank R makes it not zero. That's right.
I defined it. It has Schmidt rank R. There are log R of these guys. So you're going to have a low probability, but you have to have a non-zero.
These guys.
The probability cannot be zero.
If you want to change the state sum over.
I want to take this
from 1 to R of the non-zeros. So you want to obtain that state.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So I is a log R with string.
The I is a log R with string. So it's not going to be a non-zero probability. It's going to be low. I'm not saying that circuit is not efficient. It was not built as a circuit that could prepare efficiently the state. Since you want to have enough amount of complexity, if I can give you a circuit that does prepare it, with a low probability, doesn't matter, because from a description point of view of the circuit, the fact that you have to repeat the procedure doesn't count. It does, of course, count in communication. That was why I'm saying there's a huge difference between homography complexity and communication complexity.
Yeah, I mean, you need a loop which will tell you to repeat.
But that's almost for free. I'm just going to add at the beginning of the description, repeat it. If you obtain zero, okay. If not, redo everything from the beginning. Okay. Some relationships, and so that we're going to conclude out of time, but not too much. First of all, we have seen that the quantum chromatography complexity is related to communication. And what happens is, we have seen that the chromatography complexity of a state is at most exponential in the number of qubits. What does this imply? Well, this implies that the gap between classical and quantum communication is at most exponential. Okay, it's not a big surprise, but the nice thing is that you can do it in half a line. Oh. What else we have seen, that only a highly entangled state, in the sense that it has multipartite entanglement between the qubits itself, can be maximally complex. So this implies that in order to have this exponential gap, you need to communicate highly entangled states. Okay, this implies, of course, that entanglement is a fundamental resource. Vice versa, we've seen that the gap between classical and quantum communication complexity implies that you must have been sending from complex states. So what happens is that, okay, inequality had this exponential quantum classical gap. And what I was using were states of this form here. So this implies that at least one of the states of this form must be complex. So at least one of the states of this form must be need exponentially many in log n, because this is a log n qubit state. So it must need n gates to be prepared. What's nice is that this is a first example of a complex state. Okay, you may say I'm tricking you because I'm not giving you an example of a complex state, but of a set of states out of which one is complex. But of course, this is the best I can do because I can't tell you that this state is complex. More precisely, if you consider states of this form, you can prove that the complexity of these guys here is all inside the classical part. So the complexity of states of this form here actually coincides with the complexity of the classical bit string. Okay, just to quantum computation, the big question is how much faster are quantum computers than classical ones? Okay, we might believe or not that they can be exponentially faster, but what we do know is that if they have to be exponentially faster, then they must be using entangled states. And this was a result by Joel Sandlin. can add is that you're not only going to need entanglement, but you're going to need certain very special entangled states. Because even though they must be entangled in a number of qubits that are gross, they must be multipartite entangled in the sense I've talked about before, their complexity must grow at most polynomially within. So even though almost all n-partite entangled states have exponential complexity, you're going to have to pick up some very special ones of them that have very low complexity. This, by the way, reveals a great difference between computation and communication. What we were asking in communication were some states were very, very complex. Why this? Because somehow you wanted to get the classical information, compress it as much as possible, and send the state. In computation, what you want is somehow is to distribute your task. You want to get your classical information, spread it around so that you can work on it on more lines at a time. So that's why here you wanted to have a non-complex entangled state, and in the other case, you wanted to have highly complex entangled states. And to conclude, well, what we've done is we've found some necessary properties for any reasonable definition of homomorphic complexity, where reasonable wanted in the sense that it allows to prepare a state so that it can be used. And there's the properties that you need to have an exponential growth in the number of qubits.
So we've done this definition is
not in that sense. I guess you can find some applications, but the applications with this property would work for that definition. I guess there are some others, but I couldn't find. Given a definition that of complexity that satisfies this, it's not unique, as I'm telling you. You can find another number of ways, and there's no proof that they're equivalent yet. But given a definition that satisfies this condition, then there is a relationship between entanglement and classical complexity. And why classical is quantum theorem? Then we have shown how homomorphic complexity can actually be used to prove some statements. Of course, the things we've proven were almost trivial and all already known, but it's still it's one of the first steps in really applying the concept of quantum complexity that has been around for 6 or 7 years. So there is some hope that you can actually use it to prove some harder things, much in the same way that you do it in the classical case. So among the to-do stuff, well, there are some other applications, maybe that are not so trivial or so easy to see. Comes to my mind, there might be some relationship between the properties of some states and, for example, if they are ground states of some Hamiltonian, the property of that Hamiltonian, because, of course, if I want to describe the state, I can always describe it as a ground state of the Hamiltonian. So if that state is complex, there must be some trick inside the description of the Hamiltonian to say one. Or one could look at some other protocols, maybe for which it's not known that they give some exponential gap and just can prove or disprove something by seeing whether the state of the problem complex. And the other thing is there some relationship between the various definitions that scale exponentially? I can imagine a number of them. Can I really say that the states are complex in one definition and complex in the other two, or something of the same type? This is something we are trying to work on. And thank you for your attention.
So can there exist a quantum computer that could always calculate the quantum Hamiltonian complexity?
I don't think so, no. Because it would actually imply a number of problems. First of all, if I knew the... Well, classically, it's quite easy. If I knew the classical complexity of a classical object, then I can use this knowledge to lower its complexity. So it's actually contradictory. It's uncomputable in good sense. It's not just hard to compute. It's really uncomputable. And this passes by to the quantum case because you are using the classical complexity at the basis. So there's no computer at all that can do that.
Can you go back to page 28?
Yes. Yes, I'm trying to explain. I was telling it to go forward, but it went backwards. I don't know why. Okay.
I'm reading what you say here. What we knew, only using entanglement, a quantum qubit has a chance to express it faster.
It's specified in 12 words.
Wait. Are you referring to pure states only, or are you referring to big states?
OK, okay, I'm going to confuse things. And this is a result by Jules van Linden. And the idea is that if you consider the state, okay, you consider a protocol and you consider the state that appears inside the protocol at every step, you see that the number of entangled qubits must grow linearly, but must grow with the number of steps. So by the end of the story, you must have a lot of entanglement around. Or you can prove that you can simulate it efficiently in a classical computer.
Well, can you say anything about the next stage situation, which might be more interesting?
I can't, maybe someone else can. I wonder whether one could possibly try to, again, see if you can say something using this complexity argument. It's possible. I'm really hoping that you can use this thing to prove some stuff, because it is related to the classical information, the classical processing in general. So there is some hope to do that. But.
So, I don't know if you're aware of this, another characterization of the complexity of the state by Scott Adamson.
Yeah. Yeah, with this tree.
Yeah, this tree. Yeah. Is there any hope that that formulation will also lend itself to the Kolmogorov complexity description?
Well, I think you can probably do something like that, because the idea is that you, I read the paper a long time ago, so I didn't remember it in detail, but the idea is that you were building this sort of tree structure and defining any state there. And if I remember well, there is in general, a state will need exponentially many steps anyway to be defined.
Right, but there's nothing computational about it. I mean, there is no computer.
No, sure, but that's sort of what I need to describe you the path that I've taken to how I build the state. So there's no necessary, the computer is just, in the classical idea, it's just a formal way just to define the idea of how hard it is to describe something. And you can do it that way. I can always do it like in the number of words I need to tell you so that you understand what I'm talking about. This is also, I can describe to you a fridge in a number of, you know, talking about what it is. And after a certain number of words, you will have understood what I'm talking about. So in some sense, that is an upper part for the complexity of the object fridge. So analogously, I don't really need a computer. But at the same time, I could have to describe to a computer enough for it to build a fridge. So that would be, in some sense, the complexity of the fridge for a computer who has lower knowledge.
So is it true, at least in the quantum case, that kind of the complexity of describing the state is a bound on the Kolmogorov complexity in your definition? I mean, for instance, you might describe a state uniquely by its property that it's a fixed state or something.
Yeah, the point is that what happens is that you can imagine various definitions that satisfy the fact that they scale exponentially. And they're all based on some way of describing the state. And what I don't know is whether they are political. But I can imagine that for any of these definitions, if I describe it in such a way that then you really, it's almost as if you had it, then there must be complex states that have exponential complexity. So they might not be the same in every definition, but for any definition, there must be at least infinitely many states that have that property. So in that sense, I'm saying, even if it's not, they don't coincide, the set of complex states in all the definitions, which I really don't.
Well, yeah, no, I guess what I'm asking is, if you have some way of knowing what the state is, does it necessarily follow that you can find a circuit that will create that?
No, I don't know.
In fact, it's probably not the case, because you could think of, for example, a Hamiltonian of GCD or something like that. You could say, or of a nucleus, let's say, you could say, I have the first eigenstate, state, the second, and you just can't calculate.
Of course, then you might compose.
But can't. Remember, we have no bound on time.
Yeah, that's.
Oh.
And that's what.
So it's not obvious to me either way.
Yeah, but this is the sort of problem we're trying to face, whether we can actually really prove that these two things are equivalent. So, it doesn't matter if I need infinite time, it doesn't matter, but as long as it's finite. But if it's the age of the universe, for the Kolmogorov complexity problem, it is still fine. So that's why.
Yeah, it's fascinating, because that would be deterministic or further. You could have made some statements that you just.
Well,
It might be true, but you
Yeah, right. That's probably the only way that this couldn't. I mean, there would have to be some connection, I think.
Yeah, there would be some trick behind it, sure, but still, it's like, I think this can actually be applied to some cases. Just even only the fact that you know that there must exist a state that has this property, then you might be able to relate this to some properties of the thing with which you're describing it. In the case of the circuit, you're describing it with gates, so you're relating the complexity of the circuit to the number of gates you need to describe the circuit itself. But if you were describing it, let's say there's a ground state of a Hamiltonian of the first excited state, then it might be that if you need exponentially many bits to describe it, then it means that the Hamiltonian really either is a very complicated Hamiltonian, or you really need to describe it very, very well, because somehow if you describe it too badly, then you're going to end up in the wrong state. But there might be some way to use it in this sense, and this is something that we're going to investigate in the future.
Any more questions? I'll thank the speaker again.